Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness to come to order. Colleagues, we're going to work on the reverse plan today, sort of reverse slope. We're going to start at the bottom of the agenda and work from the bottom of the agenda to the top of the agenda so we can move through public testimony. The first public hearing we're going to have, Senator Beyer, if you'd come up, please, is SCR 20. We'll open a public hearing on SCR 20, if you would, counsel, please, and then we'll turn it over to Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 20 recognizes and honors Sergeant Brennan C. Gibson.
Welcome, Senator.
Well, thank you. For the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, and here today to ask your adoption of Senate Concurrent Resolutions 20, which honors Sergeant Brennan C. Gibson. Sergeant Gibson was killed serving our country in Iraq by IED, right? IEP? I always say that wrong. In 2006, he's survived by his wife and a young daughter, actually, son, Caden. And it's actually a sad story. He actually volunteered after graduating from OSU, was very proud to serve his country. Three days after his son was born, right?
3 days prior to deploying.
Yeah, so I'm going to let Linda give some of the details on this. She's better at this than I am. But you know, what we're talking about here is really, as you're well aware of, members, that in order to get the signs honoring the trooper up, we have to pass a resolution, and that was what we're doing here. Linda also has been very involved in serving other family members who've dealt with this afterwards, with the Blue Star and the Gold Star mothers, and it's a unique situation. And I think it's just it's the kind of thing that we need to do to serve that. I mean, those of us who have served in the military, we have a fond spot in our heart for military people, and particularly those who have given their life in service to the country. So we'll let Linda, if you would like.
Well, I just would like to say,
give your name.
Oh, Linda Gibson. I'd like to say thank you for letting us say a few words. And if I had my way, every fallen soldier would have a road sign. But as he said, Brennan deployed 3 days after his son was born and then was killed 2 months later from an IED when he was out on patrol. And I'm just briefly going to tell you a little bit, just a minute, to tell you about the patrol that he went on. He had been sick prior to this patrol for weeks with either food poisoning or something. And the night of that patrol, his commander told him, "Brennan, you don't have to go. You can stay behind because you've been sick." And he said, "No, if my guys are going, I'm going too."
Thank you, ma'am. Sir?
I would say we very proud of Brennan. He always had a desire to serve, and we were surprised when he said he wanted to join the Army, but we were behind him in the end, and we were proud the way he served the men that he worked with and how he died.
And we would like him to be remembered.
Well, ma'am, we can certainly make that happen.
Thank you.
I happen to have been involved in the training of his unit before it deployed, so I'm familiar with that. How we normally work, and so you know, is that we'll leave the record open for the public hearing for the next 7 days, and then we'll schedule it a week from now, and there'll be a work session, and then we'll bring it out of committee on a work session, and then I guess we'll ask Senator Beyer to carry it for you on the floor. It's always challenging, especially on the floor, because we've unfortunately we've done so many of these. Senator Gordon?
I'm just curious, where is the sign going to be placed? Where is the sign that, where is it going to be placed?
The request, Senator, is that it would be placed on both the north and south sides of the I-5 by the off-ramp to Highway 34 going to OSU. That's where he lived at the time.
Oh, yeah.
That's
okay.
Where he went to school.
Great. I really would like to know that. I was curious. If I might, you thank you. So I was just, yeah, I know exactly. Yeah.
Madam Vice Chair. Senator Olson.
Hi. Thank you for your sacrifice.
Again, thank you, and we will schedule it forward for a work session from a week, and then we'll pass it out, and Senator Bile will be able to stay in contact with you so you know when it goes to the floor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you. We'll close the public hearing on SCR 20 and open a public hearing on SCR 19, Madam Vice Chair. I think this is yours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 19 is available for any member who didn't have another means to request an SCR to obtain a roadside for a family that's lost a loved one. The Dash 3 amendment is Senator Monis Anderson's constituent, recognizing and honoring Corporal Jeremy Lovelace.
Adam.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know why I'm getting emotional. Dang it. I'm happy to bring the Dash, is it three?
Is it Dash 3?
Amendments to SCR 19. I didn't know Corporal Jeremy Lovelace, but he went to Gresham High, graduated 5 years after my son did. And Mr. Lovelace, his father, contacted us in a flurry of emails, phone calls, et cetera, because he would love to have a sign up near Rhododendron. Is that right? But
yeah,
I'll let you say that
close.
Later. I'll
yes.
get my stuff out first. So we started the process, and I'm just so happy that the chair and our council were able to work so quickly with us to get this into the process, as well as my staff. So I would like to have Mike Lovelace take over to talk about his son. And you can see who he is, Corporal Jeremy Lovelace. I was put on earth to serve. And then introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Michael Brandon Lovelace. I'm the father of Jeremy. Proud father of Jeremy, both pre-enlistment and, by all accounts, post-enlistment. A benchmark in my life was when we got an invitation to meet the troops when they came home to Fort Wainwright in Alaska. He was with the 2nd Army, 1st Infantry, 172nd Striker Combat Brigade, combat team. And he was a combat medic. Certainly appreciate. I only found out about this a little bit, that this is a possibility a little bit before I contacted the senator's office. And I'm very glad that the opportunity is out there. Not only for my son, but for all that have fallen. And really for those that have been in service. And I know that I am speaking for, just as a preface to this testimony, is that I know that I'm speaking for Jeremy as well, that although this will have his name on it, this is for all veterans. Fallen is the catch phrase, but it was a benchmark in my life when I was able to spend 9 days on base at Fort Wainwright, and during that time, although they had activities for, they had invited the parents of the soldiers that had fallen, had been killed. They had all kinds of activities for us to do, and I chose to spend that time with the men and women in the 172nd and commanding officers. I just stayed on base. The benchmark for me in life, I have not been in that environment. My father served. Jeremy's grandmother on my side, Jeremy's grandfather on my wife's side. He served in Korea. So there's some appreciation that I have there going to Fort Wainwright. But I had never thought about anybody else other than myself and my family. Truly, sincerely grieving this soldier's life. And that was demonstrated throughout my time there. I wish more people could, under different circumstances, have that opportunity to spend with our people that are serving. Jeremy, what I wanted to lead off with was that when Jeremy was, I believe it was his senior year in high school, Gresham High, he and I were talking about his direction, career, you know, what he had in mind. Now, we kind of went around that a little bit, and he finally said that he did not really have a destination, a career in mind, but, and this is a direct quote, that he knew, and I'll just use his words, he knew, I know that I was put on earth to help people. And that's what he did pre-military, and that's what he did after he enlisted, that same attitude. Jeremy, when he was in high school, he on his own would muster coats for the folks that are outdoors in the winter and then take them down and deliver them. He and a friend of his started up a chapter of Fellowship of Christian Athletes at Gresham High. This is the only way I can measure the success of that. At first, there was just a dozen donuts with leftovers, and at the end, it had gone to three boxes and all empty. And I know that because I bought the donuts. Jeremy was a huge heart. He was an outdoorsman. Skilled. He was a marksman before he went into the service. The sighting of the signs, both on the east and west side, that we've requested, I have longitude, latitude, and milepost numbers here, if someone should ask. there's a ropes course up there that he was an instructor at that service road. And he was all about helping people. And the ropes course purpose was to build confidence. And this was with children as well as companies, corporations, bringing their people in to learn to act as a team and to back each other up and have their trust. And he really liked doing that. Jeremy worked during high school at the car wash, which was just walk out the front door and go down about 100 yards. And it's just the way he was. And one day he came home after he had graduated and told me that he was applying for another job. And I said, "Oh, okay. What field is it? You know, what are you doing?" He said, "Well, I'll let you know." When he came home and told me that he had gotten the job and what it was, which was a high-rise window washer, I asked him, "Son, why that?" Jeremy and I both had a problem with high heights. And his reply was that he felt it was time to master that, face up to it. And so he did. And the next thing you know, we're getting photos of swinging around in a bosun's chair way up there, and something I couldn't do. During his interview, his boss took him to the top of one of the buildings and walked up to the edge and had his toes over the edge. Jeremy walked as far as he could and then crawled the rest of the way to the edge. In 2000, Jeremy married his wife, Melissa Veely, and in 2002, there was a daughter born to them, Chloe Lovelace. Jeremy was completely devoted to his family and to his Christian values. He was quite active in our church, and as one pastor told me, that he was cutting a wide swath through the activities and counseling and studies. Jeremy joined the Army in 2004 and was sent to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, for basic. After that, he went on to, as is the procedure, to finish out his advanced infantry training. He was sent to Fort Sam Houston, which happened to be the same place in a different era that my father took his AIT. I'm going to revert back to my time in Fort Wainwright. A first sergeant was assigned to take me to the lodge that the service was putting us in. And it was very nice. While we were in the lobby waiting for our turn to register, he was kind of sideways with his elbow on the desk, and I was forward with my elbows on the desk. And I said, tell me the truth. You can't hurt me anymore. or any further, I guess, would be more applicable. But does and did Jeremy earn all of the accolades and before that, I said, I don't know what you guys usually do if you fluff it up, you know, to make things sound to ease the grieving one's time. But I asked him to be honest with me, and there's no doubt in my mind that he was. He'd been in the service 15 years. He squared around to me in a military stance, and he said, sir, your son was the finest medic I have ever served with. I tried every trick in the book to get him attached to my platoon permanently. That really didn't happen. Jeremy didn't really see the big deal in doing his job as well as his superiors saw him doing his job. He was just doing it. And it came quite natural to him. During his time there, he, rather than, as I'm told by his captain and his staff sergeant at Fort Wainwright at the time of the return, that medics are typically 1 to 2, maybe 3 platoon assignments. Jeremy served with 10. I asked why, and his response was that the men were confident in him. He had proven himself. They knew that he would be there, and that Jeremy, on 2 hours sleep, was better than most on 5. Now, on the Army portion of my testimony here, just as a perspective, here I am, a proud father who's lost his son and know him in civilian life and his heart and his direction. And with all that I heard while I was at Fort Wainwright, I'm seeing a different man, a different side of him, in an environment that now has given me great respect for veterans. All the platoons that he had served with, my phone was just ringing off the hook. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, beers, little pool after work. And these were all with men with different platoons. So I'm hearing this about my son as he had grown into his new profession. And they were giving it to me straight. I have no doubt in my mind about that. Uh, His staff sergeant, that was his immediate report, and responsible for assignments, was very impressed with Jeremy's growth as he had come in, and referred to him as the go-to guy who could fix any situations. Again, part of the reason that he served with so many platoons. He was always I was told that morale would go up in a platoon. He always had a smile on his face. I don't know where it is in here, but captain who's a surgeon for the brigade said that he never heard in all think of this battle environment, he never heard Jeremy cuss or swear, which really doesn't speak to anything other than his inner discipline, and that had never been part of his life when he was a civilian. One day, Jeremy was sent back twice for advanced training to what was then just Fort Lewis. And that came about because his staff sergeant was in his room, and he saw the books that Jeremy had on his shelf, and they were all medical books, because he would be studying in his off time. And it was the staff sergeant, Michael Walker, who was told me this, and he said, "Where are you getting these books?" He'd been sending for them online, purchasing them. And so Staff Sergeant Walker said, "You just tell him, don't buy any more. Tell me what you need." And he got the books to Jeremy. This basically, I'm following kind of what I wrote, but I'm speaking from the heart and from facts. And the testimony that I'm giving about his accomplishments in the service is I'm trying to come across with that portion of it because it's what I've been told and what I have all kinds of emails about is I'm trying to present this objectively. I'm more subjective, I believe, before he went in because then he was under my care. One of Jeremy's sergeants said to me, here I was telling Jeremy what to do and giving him orders when I'm thinking that this guy is twice the medic I will ever be and should be telling me what to do. There are other things that are in here. The one thing that is not in here that I will would definitely like to add to the testimony is that upon return to the base when I was fortunate enough to be invited there and to mix it up with the people that were coming home for their block leave, Jeremy was nominated to have, they were building a new. They hadn't gone any further than the footings for the building. Jeremy was nominated to have that, and it was the new combat medics training center at Fort Wainwright. And the guys told me that this might not even get off base. You know, I'm sure you guys, there's procedures, there's administrative. So they kept me abreast, kept me in the loop. It made it off the base. Colonel signed off on it. Went to Arctic Command and went through their different levels. And the commanding general, signed off on it. And it went to PACCOM, Pacific Command, and General Brown was commanding then. And I was able to reach his aide, and I basically, the last name is what he keyed on, and he said, yes, we do have the recommendation here. It has not made General Brown's desk yet. Then crickets. I don't know what happened. But just the fact that the company as a whole, the battalion as a whole, would nominate him for this, for an enlisted man. And they told me that it would be unique for an enlisted man to have this honor. But they felt strongly enough. It's in here too. The colonel of the battalion told me that they considered Jeremy their battalion medic. And then when word came over the radio that he had indeed been killed by a sniper while on patrol, he said you could have heard a pin drop. I share these things with you from perspective of a proud father, with all aspects of my son's life, and I'm glad that I was fortunate enough to have him for 26 years. He is my eldest son. The coming home party that was at the end of the week, those that have served will get the feeling of this, I'm sure, is that the platoon sergeant on the striker that he was killed on, he was on lookout. He was not acting as a medic. And this, he would volunteer to go out on patrols. And he had several stories of finding stashes of guns in rooms beneath coffee houses and such. So Jeremy spent, it wasn't a gunslinger. His attitude simply that was that he was helping and doing his part when he went out on patrol. not as a medic. And he did this very often. With that, I don't... I think you get the gist of it. Any questions?
You were going to tell us the location.
I still will. It is in longitude and latitude 45 degrees 18556 north, 120 degrees 50.472 west, and it is approximately mile marker 48.5.
On Highway 26.
On Highway 26.
Near Rhododendron.
What we're requesting is both eastbound and westbound signs. Mm-hmm. This location is just Jeremy's brothers, Nicholas, Brandon, and I went up to look for something close to the service road because it was something that he was proud of and would be, in our mind, would be very appropriate. What we went up there with an eye for, no traffic congestion, out of the way, but still visible, no foliage over, trees hanging over it, don't have to clear anything that I'm aware of. I don't know what ODOT does. I don't really know their prereqs. But again, both eastbound and westbound, because that's where he spent his time hiking, rock climbing, just anything to do with the outdoors. So we would appreciate it if we can. We'd be honored, really. We're very proud of Jeremy. We would be honored if we can get that sighting. We understand that there's more involved with ODOT survey and that, but that's our reason for asking for this particular sighting.
Yeah. Well, generally, ODOT is fairly cooperative on these particular issues, so I'm quite confident of that, and I greatly appreciate your testimony. It's there is... no amount of thanks when someone loses someone. Having been there and done that, I do find, Madam Vice Chair, that I don't know if it's just irony of the day, but the previous, if you didn't listen, the previous bill that we had honoring Trooper Gibson, he was actually in the same unit serving in the same area and killed 6 months later.
172nd?
He is actually in the 509th, Charlie Airborne of the 509th, attached to them from Fort Richardson on the same deployment to Mosul.
Oh.
So
I didn't catch that. Yeah, I didn't know that part.
Once again, I am familiar with that unit, and I actually served in combat in Mosul 3 years before there. And just for the record, ironically, we have combat troops from the United States right now on the ground in Mosul fighting today.
Yes, I'm very well aware of that, and thank you for your service. I feel as if more so early on that through the men and women that I spoke to at Fort Wainwright, if you can just think of a slot in a Stryker vehicle, that I have seen an image. I have an image in my mind that, of course, is mixed in with what I've seen on television and that. But the dirt roads, something that Jeremy, when he was in his lookout post on the strike or on patrol, something that he did and liked very much, and also at any time, was throwing candy to the kids. Which, he was asked why he was there, and he said, it's where I'm supposed to be. I believe that to be true. It's really hard to admit that still. But that simply fell right in line with his life.
Thank you again for your testimony. And Senator Morris Anderson will be in touch with you. As I said, if you listen to the earlier hearing, we'll carry it over for a week for other testimony and then right. The following. We also have another individual to honor under that same resolution. Good. If you would, counsel.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you for hearing.
Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are two other amendments. There is a dash one amendment that recognizes and honors the Evans family of Klamath Falls, Oregon, particularly two brothers, and Mr. Bates is responsible for causing that amendment to be drafted. And there is an amendment we've yet to receive at the request of your office honoring Lance Corporal Hart.
Right.
And when that's received, it should be in time for the
Steve
former
Bates.
Schedule in the bill.
Chair Boquist, Vice Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, I'm Steve Bates. It's my honor to serve as the chair of the Committee on Memorials and Remembrance. For over 20 years, our nation was involved in a military conflict that eventually was known as the Vietnam War. During this involvement, over 58,000 American families became Vietnam War Gold Star families. Of these families, there were 39 that lost two sons to this war. Four of these families were in Oregon. During the last legislative session, the Wright family of Boring was appropriately honored for the loss of their two sons in Vietnam. Today, we wish to start the process to honor the Evans family of Klamath County with the Dash 1 Amendment to SCR 19. The Evans family lost two sons in Vietnam. The Evans family story is interesting to say the least. James Evans married Juanita Mulahan. Juanita had children from a previous marriage, and James accepted them as his own. The family had four boys, Robert, Norman, David, and John. Now, James Evans, the father, was a World War II and Korean War Air Force veteran. All four boys served in the United States Army. And it must also be noted that his grandson served in the Oregon Army National Guard. This is a family that served its country well. David Lynn Evans enlisted in the Army shortly after graduating from high school in 1967. He achieved the rank of Specialist 4 and was a door gunner with the U.S. Army's 191st Assault Helicopter Company when he died outright during a hostile engagement on October 24, 1968, at the age of 19. Norman Francis Evans also enlisted in the Army. Now, let's be perfectly clear. All four boys enlisted. They were not drafted. This is a family that volunteered. The second boy to Norman Francis Evans was born 10 months after the death of his younger brother. Norman and his wife named their second son after Specialist 4, David Lynn Evans. Norman Evans did not have to go to Vietnam, as his brother had served and died there. It is reported that Norman felt that it was his duty and accepted his assignment to Vietnam. He died in an airplane crash that killed 16 people on November 24, 1970, at the age of 23. This was Norman's second tour in Vietnam, and he was just 3 weeks away from coming home. James and Juanita Evans raised a great family. They lost two of their boys to Vietnam. Unfortunately, they are now deceased. We wish to take this time to honor their contributions and their memory. The one family survivor that we have been able to locate is the oldest son of Norman Evans. His name is Jeff. Jeff Evans has a family of his own and resides in Nevada. His brother, who is the namesake of David Lynn Evans, passed away in 2011. David Lynn Evans, the younger, served two tours in the Iraq War. He was injured during his second tour, and his death was contributed to those injuries. Jeff Evans has expressed his desire to be here today, but is unable to do so because of employment responsibilities. We ask that this resolution with the -1 amendment be passed to the Senate floor with a due adopt recommendation. Let us honor the Evans family. This resolution, when passed, will enable the process for signage and the dedication of a state highway in Klamath County as a Fallen Hero Memorial Highway in memory of U.S. Army Specialist 4, David Lynn Evans, and U.S. Army Specialist 6, Norman Francis Evans, two heroes that were brothers. They sacrificed their American dream so that we could live ours. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And the public record will be held open for another week, and we'll do a work session a week from today. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on the bill?
With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on SCR 19 and open a public hearing again on SB 707. Council, if you would just briefly review this, and I'm going to ask Director Koba and Director Hill to make their way up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 707 was previously heard on March 28th. It has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. It's the measure that authorizes the Treasury to issue Article 11Q General Obligation Bonds at the request of Legislative Administration Committee for the 2719 and the 2019-21 bienniums for seismic upgrades to this building, and it takes effect July 1st, 2017.
And colleagues, you recall in the previous public hearing we had a discussion and a wonderance of what our colleagues in the executive branch were thinking about in terms of seismic recovery and future recovery and emergency preparedness in the Capitol area. So we've invited the good director of DAS to come over and share a little bit of their future plans to see if there's some integratable way with the other half or third of the government. So, Director, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Katie Koba, Chief Operating Officer and Director of DAS. I have to say, it's a little difficult to get up here after hearing that testimony. So, in terms of our thinking about disaster preparedness, disaster recovery, I'm sure you all know that last June the state participated, the executive branch part of the state participated in an exercise preparing for a Cascadia event. And while I was not in this position at that time, I can kind of give you a high-level perspective on at least our thinking at this point in time, which is the Anderson Readiness Center out on State Street would be the place where we would congregate following a major disaster. And really, in essence, those first 30 days post-disaster is all about responding to the disaster and doing everything that we can to help the citizens of the state of Oregon. Following that 30 days, the planning effort right now includes a new building on the Capitol Mall on what is currently the yellow lot. And there is planning money for both a new building as well as a new parking structure that would include the capacity for energy generation and fuel storage on the red lot next to the yellow lot. So that planning money has been included in DAS's budget request for this go-around. Obviously, if it is approved, we are still years away from having that facility complete. The buildings on the Capitol Mall, and I'm not referring to the Capitol now, but in a significant Cascadia event, the prediction is they would all fall down, with the exception of perhaps the ODOT building, which just went through significant renovation. So assuming we move forward with yellow lot, red lot facilities and those buildings are constructed, that would be considered kind of the operational side of government in that building post a 30-day response period moving forward. That being said, obviously, not everyone is going to fit in one building. And so as you all talk about what you're doing with the Capitol building, I don't think there's been a lot of conversation about coordination between the legislative branch, judicial branch, and executive branch. But I think it is probably a very wise and prudent thing to do in terms of getting this building to a place where it stands and how we would coordinate and what's the best maximum use of the facilities that would still be standing following an event. Long term, if we were to have a building on the yellow lot, what we'd like to do is rotate agencies that are currently on the mall into that building and then proceed with renovation of other executive department buildings on the mall to seismically retrofit those buildings as well. This would not be up to the standards of the yellow lot building, but really to prevent those buildings from falling down in the case of a emergency. Obviously, we're decades out from having that work done, but that really, in a kind of a high-level nutshell, is what we're thinking about moving forward. I think without a doubt there is a need for us to collectively, as I said, the judicial, legislative, and executive branch to get together and really talk about this building, and if the seismic retrofit is done here, what makes sense with the Anderson Readiness Center, this building, and if we're far enough down the road to also have the yellow lot building and the parking structure with the electricity and fuels capacity. So it seems to me that the time is right. We certainly welcome that and look for guidance from you all on the best way to do that.
Well, thank you, because I mean, the Treasurer, Secretary of State, and Governor occupy the building with us now.
Yes.
And previously, you know, we haven't looked at it as quite as an encompassing all government structure since the Cascadia event and the growing awareness of the public that it's likely to happen and it's likely to be much worse than anybody thought. It's the importance of having a center of government, an area of hope, an ability to look someplace and focus, frankly, not on the eastern side like we've all abandoned everything, but closer in the thick of it, starts to make more sense and be more more sense, but yet it's staying problematic of having to do that coordination between entities. The constitutional, as you and I talked, Director, the constitutional amendment that took us 10 years to get out to the ballot, despite being actually proposed by Governor Kulongoski, my first freshman term here, as you know, the legislature comes into session automatically and would occupy at least temporarily the building for, in that interim 30 days or in the beginning for a while, to do those duties that we need to do to assist the governor and the executive branch. But unfortunately, there won't be what we would consider a quorum that we would recognize today, most likely. And so there will be other space in the Capitol. And one of the takeaways that has come from lots of planning, not just Cascadia, is the ability to have a functioning 24/7 government off the grid that can communicate and can actually be the beacon of hope, so to speak. So that's sort of the direction we're going, which is why we asked Director Hill to come here. We're looking out in front of ourselves, too. And I think under the invitation of the committee structure, if nothing else, we're going to try and expand the discussion to get a little bit more interoperability for that going forward and plan a little bit wider than we've thought about before, but a little bit more long-term. And I think Director Hill is going to give us sort of his insights. We have a CAM that's kind of going in process, which doesn't solve seismic things, but it does provide some other upgrades. And, of course, as you know, we have power generation here and things like that. But, Director, I'll let you jump in.
Sure.
And if you want to drag your staff up here, you can, too. It's up to you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, why don't I do a quick update on where we are, continuity of government and continuity of operations, and then I'll have Marina come up and give you an overview of the CAMS project. Is that okay?
Good.
Okay, so last summer, legislative administration, we began a branch-wide continuity of government and operations project. There is a capital security work group that was put together. The chair of this committee is on that. The chair of the like committee on the House side is on that also. And the group approved us moving forward with continuity of operations project. And since that time, we have actually entered into a contract with a vendor. Legislative administration is going to be the first group through it. The first group includes the Office of the Administrator, Employee Services, Financial Services, and Facility Services. We've already gone and done the initial training there. We've begun entering data for the COOP plans, and we're somewhere between 70 and 90% done for those groups. It's going to be a long process. It's going to take us probably 2 years to get everybody in the building through that process. But we now, it'll be a large database when it's all done. This vendor does this nationwide. They have several other governments and other large entities that they do this with. So it's looking very promising as we've gotten started. Along those lines, one of the issues, as you both mentioned, is continuity of government, which is what happens after a very large disaster. And so we've also, as part of that plan, looked at talking to legislative council about what kind of both statutory and potentially constitutional changes will need to be made along those lines so that there is the ability for all three branches to still continue afterwards. Mm-hmm. We have reached out a couple times to the resilience office and the governor's office, and they have made contact with us. I think you're right. It's the beginning, and there's a lot of that that needs to be done to make sure that the three branches all together have plans that interact so that government itself can continue. So that's a short summary of that. If you'd like to have Marina come forward and discuss the CAMS project, or if you have questions, I'd be happy to.
We can have Marina come forward. And Director, you're welcome to stay, or you're welcome to go back and save the rest of the state. You're quite welcome to do that. I have a list of items, you know, on your desk for me, myself, and I, so that you could address.
I do.
But
yes.
I would just point out that what we do need as we move forward is to improve the level of communications at the higher levels, because what we're talking about, though you have a sort of different mechanism at our side, you know, it is significant to go out and ask for $300 million in bonding and things like that. And so we don't want to make a mistake of doing the wrong thing and making sure everything's integratable, because life after no electricity will be significantly different than it is today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree. I think you've had a lot more experience at that than probably any of us here. And frankly, I really don't want to go through it, but we need to be prepared to do so.
Any questions for the director before she goes? Mr. Hill, you can.
I'll have Marina come up.
Okay.
Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marina Cresswell. I'm the project manager for the Capital Accessibility Maintenance and Safety Project, otherwise known as CAMS. I was asked to provide an overview and sort of an update on the CAMS project. I'm going to assume that some folks may not understand or know all of the things that are included under the CAMS project, so I'm going to provide a fairly brief overview of what the project includes and then give you some information about where we are currently in completing the project. The CAMS project was approved in the 2016 legislative session with an approval of bond sales of $30 million for a total project budget of $50 million. It was essentially an outgrowth of the Oregon State Capitol Renovation Project, which had completed design work in 2015 but had not received funding for construction. CAMS did not have the funding to do all of the work that was designed under the Oregon State Capitol renovation, so portions of the work were pulled out. Items that were intended to address maintenance issues that had been waiting essentially for the Capitol renovation to be complete, or things such as accessibility, which are missing here in the building, and some safety issues as well. So the title of the project comes from addressing those three categories: accessibility, maintenance, and safety. Under accessibility, we're looking at things like simple things like door hardware, door thresholds, hardware in bathroom stalls, allowing people to get in and out of places. The bigger picture of that is accessible entries to the building itself. We currently have one accessible entry to this building. CAMS will provide accessible entries at all four faces of the building, so north, south, east, and west. The maintenance projects, we have some fairly significant major maintenance projects, including resealing all of the exterior stone and windows, roof repairs, skylight repairs, addressing significant utility infrastructure for the building. We have a number of unsafe infrastructure items that we do need to take care of. We're doing that by way of creating underground vaults for utility infrastructure that will address changing over our heating system from steam boilers to hot water system. They'll also address things like providing new electrical feed to the Capitol building and a fairly significant number of equipment upgrades or replacements that are long overdue. Our safety projects are kind of a mixed bag. They're, when we say safety, we mean both life safety and security. So they address things on multiple fronts. One of the things that we are doing, we'll be moving the Oregon State Police permanently to the first floor of the Capitol building. As you know, we have already moved them there temporarily, and I'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. We are also going to be upgrading our emergency generator and providing additional capacity with that generator. And we are providing a new set of exit stairs, enclosed exit stairs at the north side of the building. It's a fairly significant intervention to the building within the historic envelope of the building. Those exit stairs will allow us to better get people out of the building in an emergency from the north side, which is very underserved in terms of egress. And it will do it within an enclosed environment, which meets code. It will get people directly out of the building. As part of doing that, we will also be adding accessible entries into those stair areas. So we are creating entryways at the ground floor that provide accessible entry from the north side. They also provide that egress from the exit stairs in from the north portion of the building. We have been working on the project since approximately June or July of last year, and in that time we have had to do a number of preparatory activities in order to open up some of those spaces where the new exit stairs are going to be. That includes moving the revenue office out of their traditional location. They are ultimately going to be moving to room 160, which is where the governor's staff are currently located. We need that space to be open, and then we will need to reconfigure it before we can move revenue in there. In the meantime, we have moved them temporarily up to room 354, and we have already completed most of the design work for room 160 to get that configuration complete. As soon as 160 is vacated at the end of July this year. We also have moved information services first floor staff down to the lower level with the rest of the information services staff in room 40. In total, they're in a smaller space than the two groups had previously, so we had to make some configuration changes. And we also needed to move the Oregonian offices slightly north, so we shifted them north. We moved the register guard to a different location within the press area and created some new construction and new furniture layouts for information services to make that move happen. The space that revenue and information services moved out of on the first floor, a portion of that space is going to be the north exit. The other portion of the space is going to be the permanent location of the Oregon State Police. Currently, we have moved them temporarily into the north exit stair piece of that so that we could have them upstairs prior to the start of session. while we continue working on configuring their permanent location. We do have those documents complete. We are getting ready to go out to bid and expect to complete the reconfiguration of their space by the end of session and have them moved in by the end of session. We are also working on relocating a historic camper down Elms from the east and west sides of the building. They're directly adjacent to the east and west entries of the building. We are needing to relocate those elms in order to dig out and construct the mechanical vaults that will be going underground in those locations. So we are in the process of executing our contract for that. And we had hoped to do the relocation during April, but the month is moving by very quickly. So given weather and other considerations, it's likely it'll be closer to May that we're able to do that relocation. We're also working on design of a reconfigured suite for Treasury. Treasury will also have to vacate some portion of their current space in order to make way for the north exit stairs. So we are working on that design as well. And we're in discussion with the governor's staff about where they're going to move after they vacate 160. The larger piece of the work, we are going to solicit the construction as a construction manager general contractor contract. That typically would be used to bring a contractor on board to assist in the design process to help ensure that the design decisions are effective and efficient from a construction perspective as well. We already have a significant amount of design work that we are reusing from the Oregon State Capitol renovation. However, we think it would be advantageous to bring a contractor on early, given the short time frame that we have available to do the construction. We'd like to bring them on board in order to get everybody up and running as quickly as possible. The project is expected to be complete by June 30th of 2019, and we've been asked to keep everybody in the building and still allow all of the legislative activities to occur with minimal impact. So that means that we have to think very carefully about when and how we do our construction. We are almost ready to put the solicitation out for that construction manager, general contractor. And in the meantime, we are moving forward with our design work for the larger piece of the work. We are doing more detailed assessments of our existing conditions. Under the Oregon State Capitol renovation, the intent was that we would be replacing much of our existing infrastructure and everybody would be moved out of the building. That allowed us a great amount of freedom to simply tear out everything and not be too concerned about the details of how bad of shape it was in. Under the CAMS project, we don't have the funding to do that. And we are intending to keep as many pieces as we possibly can. And we also need to keep everything operational. So that means that we need to do a much more detailed assessment of our existing conditions. And that assessment is in progress. One of the challenges, of course, of keeping the building operational is that we need to keep all of our existing systems in place and put new systems into place in the same amount of space. So we have been working diligently to address that challenge. We have some other design challenges, things that in the state capitol renovation were highly interdependent. We've pulled those parts out in CAMS, so now we have to figure out how they work without the other pieces. That has created some challenges that I don't think were anticipated at the start of the project, and we're slowly working through those. We are, we do, because of those challenges, we do have some concerns that the project may go a little bit longer than the original timeline, and we are keeping a pretty close eye on that as we work through the design piece of it. Our next steps are to do the build-out of the Oregon State Police permanent location, get that complete so that we can move them in there. The solicitation for the construction manager general contractor contract and the relocation of the camper down Elms. Construction documents for the rest of the project we anticipate being complete in July or late July. And I'm open for questions.
Let me ask a couple of framing questions. At the end of the state, Maria, if I call correct, Treasurer, Secretary of State, Governor are still here, correct?
That's correct.
So, and if all goes well in your world on June 30th, 2019, we've progressed to the far end of CAMS, and we're ready for the next bright idea. And so a question, and I follow you, I mean, for continuity of government, which I know is not your specialty, but I'm looking at Darren here, and the notion that in a catastrophic event, we would not just have a standing building, but we would be using end bonds and other things for seismic preparation and emergency services, i.e. continuity of government here, not someplace else. In your experience, in the present design planning, I mean, we would need in the future to have 24/7 power, standalone water, sewer access, communications, something slightly different and much closer to what the executive branch is planning at the other end of the mall. I would assume to take even some of the planning that we have now, that just the design and planning of that would take several years to put it together, i.e., not before the end of CAMS.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, yes, it would take several years to put that together. It would not be complete before the end of CAMS. I would like to caution that the building itself has limitations in how far you can take a seismic retrofit without destroying the historic fabric. So the ability to retrofit an existing building seismically is very different than what you can do with a new construction, particularly for a historic building. I think it would be unfortunate if people assumed that this building could be made into a emergency operations center quality retrofit.
So in short, even if we did a seismic retrofit, it could fall down around us.
I'm not an expert in seismic. The intent is to keep it from falling down around us, yes. But there are different levels that it would need to be designed for, and what was intended under the Oregon State Capitol renovation was not to that highest level of seismic safety.
So I guess it's safe to say that we kind of would need to restart planning. If we wanted it to go to that level, that we would have to start not sort of anew, but it would take a little bit more planning than we thought about in the past.
If you wanted to take it to a different level than what was anticipated in the Oregon State Capitol renovation, you would certainly be starting fresh in many respects. And I'm not sure it would be possible.
Jump in.
Well, Mr. Chair.
There's no sharks in the swimming pool yet. I'm just pointing this out to you.
As you know, I would defer. I've only been the legislative administrator here for about 6 months now. And Marina, came onto the Oregon State Capitol renovation project late, but she understands those things much more than I would. So I would, and if she says that, I would agree with her.
Okay. And I believe we have engineering staff that are on contract now, right?
We do.
Right. And to do a assessment to figure to be integratable with the future executive branch at the other end of the mall 6 years from now, how much effort or conceptual work would it require engineers to do to sort of figure that out, in your professional opinion? I'm not saying what it costs, so on and so forth, of whatever it's, one, doable, and two, is it in the realm of possibilities?
Chair Boquist, there was a significant amount of assessment analysis done during the master planning process, for the State Capitol Master Plan, as well as the initial stages of the Oregon State Capitol renovation. Mm-hmm. And so I think it would behoove us to go back and look at the analysis and assessment that was done there in terms of what can be achieved for seismic safety level for this building. Because that is really going to be the piece that dictates everything else. Mm-hmm. Uninterruptible water, sewer connections. None of those things really matter if the seismic can't be what you want it to be.
Correct. If I recall correctly, and I know you weren't here, but I believe one of the engineers was involved in the original study, testified a week ago, right? I'm looking for Mr. Wilhelmsbecker, if he remembers the name of the...
Mr. Chair, I think that was not one of the engineers. I believe that was one of the person who had worked for the construction firm, not one of the engineers.
Okay. Right.
Correct.
And if we were to look at, you know, the feasibility of it, do we have a sort of a how long it would take us to I mean, I'm assuming we have some standby contracts or whatever to be able to reach back to those design people that looked at it, and it's not, if they've done the work, most of them are engineers, they're going to have a sort of a first reaction like you're going to have and say, this is what's probably doable and this is probably what's not doable. I assume that's correct.
I think we could probably pull out information that would give you that analysis, mm-hmm. Without having to go back and ask somebody to right. look at it again.
Right. And is that something that's doable in a relatively short amount of time, just in rough order of magnitude?
Mr. Chair, I would assume so, yes.
Yes.
You know, it's the same architect,
right.
I'm sure we can work with them.
Right. Well, then I'll... Because we're running out of time, we'll come back and we'll ask you to do that and give us sort of a, not a rough order of magnitude, but a rough order of possibilities.
Okay.
And along that line. Questions, Madam Vice Chair?
No.
Senator Olson?
I have one. You kind of piqued my interest a little bit when you talked about the building would stand and we could get out of it. The question is, after that, do we need to bulldoze the building or is it still going to be usable?
It should require... repairs, but not bulldozing. Yeah.
Small bulldozer, right?
I hope not.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, we'll visit a little bit offline to see what possibilities are forward. But I mean, you know, my envisionment and discussions with other members in leadership have been really we need to have a plan and. It's probably not a plan that we can execute in the next 3 to 6 months. It's more of a plan as a follow-on mission to CAMS. But I've actually not heard quite the testimony as I just heard before. So I guess we sort of need to figure out what is our possibilities and what are really the levels after we do seismic retrofit and a little bit of discussion on that. So we will get back with you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Right.
Anybody else that wants to have comments on 707 at the moment? We are going to hear it again, whether you like it or not, just so you know. Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on SB 707. I want to open a very quick work session on SB 796, which is Senator Manning's bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 796 is up for work session, as you indicated. It was previously heard on March 7th. And you'll recall, Amy Joyce is present to make our record today. You'll recall there was a simple process and a more complicated process, and to avoid a fiscal impact, they've worked out the simplified process, so she's here to talk about that. There is currently a minimal fiscal and a minimal revenue on a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment merely conforms the language concerning service and the type of discharge for consistency with existing law, and the measure creates a parking permit or decal for individuals with service-connected disabilities of 50% or more.
You're on, Amy, quick.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. Want to put two items on the record. One is that under the bill and with the -1 amendment, to make very clear that folks seeking this benefit need to prove initially that they qualify as a person with a disability. So they have a mobility issue or vision issue where they would qualify for a parking placard in the first place. Then on top of that, the 50% service connected gets the increased benefit for the wounded warrior. It's not real clear if you just look at the face of the bill. It has to do with the context of the statutes around it. Just want to be very clear about that. Second item to put on the record is how DMV would implement this. So rather than the expensive deal where you would put it into the computer system, we would issue the standard parking placard the individual qualifies for, and then an additional sticker or something like that to indicate that that honor that honorific, and then also the slightly increased benefit that you get from that. That will not be tracked in the computer system. Slight concerns about fraud, but just so that's out there, it won't be in the computer system. And then every 8 years, when the individual comes back, renews their driver license, and renews that parking placard, they're again going to have to show that that's 50% disabled, service-connected disabled documentation, again, every 8 years, because it isn't in the system. That's how we'll do it. It keeps it cheap, and that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, we're in work session.
Chair, both of us. I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments into Senate Bill 796.
Madam Vice Chair, Monsignor moves the Dash 1 amendments into 796 to 21717. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair.
Focus, I move Senate Bill 796 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monsignor moves SB 796 as amended by the Dash 1 to the floor with a due pass. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? So ordered, and Senator Manning will carry his own bill. Thank you. That will close the work session on SB 796. And colleagues, we are done for another week. Have a nice week. Have a nice week. Six. And colleagues, we are done.